On this episode of Skeptico, author of The Men Who Stare at Goats, John Ronson.
They stuck a bunch of soldiers in a room at Fort Meade in Maryland, including some who've gone on to become quite famous paranormal buffs like Ed Danes and Joe McMonagall and Ingo Swann and so on. And they kind of stuck them in a room and told them to be psychic. And some of them tried to be psychic for like 20 years. And they do point to some remote viewing successes. But even if they did manage to harness psychic powers, which, you know, I suspect they probably didn't. But even if they did, there was still nothing the military could do with it.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris. And on this episode, I have a very interesting interview with the author and really main character behind the movie Men Who Stare at Goats, John Ronson. Now, of course, I was more interested in the science behind the movie and the skeptical spin on it. I mean, having people like Hal Puthoff and Stephen Schwartz establish that remote viewing really works and that the military should be interested in it. So we had a chance to talk about that and a number of other John's projects. And stick around for the end of the interview, and I'll tell you about a little bit of the additional research I did and some of the follow-up email exchange I had with John. Here's my dialogue with John Ronson. We're joined by quite a fascinating guy. He's a writer, documentary filmmaker, several international bestsellers, including Them, Adventures with Extremists, and a book that we were just chatting a little bit about that's going to be turned into a movie starring George Clooney, The Men Who Stare at Goats. John Ronson, thank you for joining me on Skeptico.
Oh, that's my pleasure, Alex. And in fact, the movie is about to come out. It's coming out on November the 6th. It's finished and ready to go.
And is that going to be released at the same time in the United States as well as in the UK?
Yep. It seems to be getting released in both countries on the same day. It's been shown at a few festivals. It was shown in Venice and in Toronto and in Austin. And a lot of people seem to like it. And it's about the kind of things that interest your listeners, I think. It's about how the U.S. military in the 80s, post-Vietnam, became really interested in the paranormal. They got into a sort of bubble of thought in which they believed that it was possible to teach the American soldier how to walk through walls and become invisible and kill goats just by staring at them, hence the name of the book and movie. And they spent a long time, you know, trying to you know, drop goats by staring at them, and once or twice goats did fall over, but presumably out of boredom as opposed to actual, you know, paranormal powers on the part of the soldiers.
Oh, really? I found all that quite fascinating. I have to say, in some of the interviews I had heard from before, it sounded like the results from a paranormal standpoint were a little more mixed. I take it that they did have some sense that there was something going on, not that they could weaponize it in any way that made sense for the military, but they had some rather interesting kind of effects, right?
Yeah, well, they believe that they, you know, managed some stuff. They believe that, you know, they managed to drop a few goats in their time. You know, they never managed to pass through walls, but they think they had success with the remote viewing experiments. You know about this, that they stuck a bunch of soldiers in a room at Fort Meade in Maryland, including some who've gone on to become quite famous paranormal buffs like Ed Danes and Joe McMonagall and Ingo Swann and so on. And they kind of stuck them in a room and told them to be psychic. And some of them tried to be psychic for like 20 years. And they do point to some remote viewing successes. But as you say, it was really hard to find military applications for it. So, you know, even if they did manage to harness psychic powers, which, you know, I suspect they probably didn't, but even if they did, there was still nothing the military could do with it. You can't kind of launch an offensive based on a psychic intuition. So after a while, it got kind of shut down.
You know, that's what I thought would be interesting to chat with you about, John, because you've really explored so many of these interesting little quirky subcultures that we have, and you've done it with a lot of wit and a lot of insight. And what's your takeaway on some of these, I hate to use the term paranormal, but these parapsychology effects? And in particular, it seems like recently you've gotten into kind of the intersection of maybe strange beliefs with religion.
Well, you know, sadly, I've become more and more skeptical as I've gone along when it comes to actually believing in the possibility of these powers. I kind of don't. And in fact, when there's no question for me anymore, I find it quite hard to write about it, because the stuff that I write about is quite humanist and it's quite gentle and nice. And I don't go in there like Randy, you know, knowing exactly what I believe and sort of wanting to, you know, wanting to kind of tell people they're wrong. You know, I like to do things in a kind of more gentle and humanist way. So, for instance, my first book then was about conspiracy theorists. And back then, I believed it was possible that their conspiracy theories were true. And I sort of don't believe that anymore. So I couldn't write a book like them anymore. And The Menhirsteric Goats was about, you know, the possibility of there being paranormal powers, you know, harnessed by the US military. And I don't believe that's possible anymore. So again, I couldn't really write that book now because, you know, you don't want to go to all these, you know, former military psychics and say, well, I just don't believe you. I just don't believe, I think you just wasted your time, you know, because then you don't get an interesting layered story.
There's a certain cynicism that I think develops if you're really, if you're really totally shut down to the idea and you continue to report it as if you're openly investigating it. And that's to your credit. I think that comes through in your work. You know, I was wondering what you think maybe about, in particular, when you talk about remote viewing. I mean, Richard Wiseman, someone in the UK, is quite a public figure in terms of a scientific investigator of these kind of claims. As recently in the magazine Red Nova was quoted as saying that he thinks that the scientific evidence for remote viewing by any other standard has been established. What do you make of...
Really?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And gosh, I never knew you said that. That's interesting.
Yeah, I think he then goes on to say, it begs the question, do we need a higher standard for evidence that is so revolutionary? And he suggests that we do. I don't know how
Well, remote viewing is a tough one. You know, it's easy with kind of goat staring. You know, you kind of know. They call that remote influencing, the idea that you can actually influence events with the power of your mind. You know, that seems pretty open and shut that it's not possible. The difficult thing about remote viewing, of course, is, you know, when you see the 20 years of experiments, you'll see plenty of occasions when they'll have sketched something, you know, based on a kind of psychic viewing of a map coordinate, and the sketch looks rather like the actual thing that's in the map coordinate. And I never really knew what to do with that piece of information. And if I'm being completely honest, when I was writing The Menhirsteric Goats, I decided that I didn't want to write a book which tried to prove or disprove the claims. I wanted to write a study of the, almost like a kind of soap opera of the people involved in these programs, a sort of comedy about hanging out with them. So more like a kind of Errol Morris type thing, yeah, than a Richard Wiseman thing. So, you know, I feel slightly unqualified. You know, my guess is that there's no truth in the claims, but I'm really interested to know what Richard Wiseman, and in fact, I'm doing something with him this weekend at TAM London, so I'll ask him about that. I'd be fascinated to know what he makes of it.
Yeah, because I think the hard evidence that's come in when they really control those kind of experiments are highly suggestive that something is going on. Of course, when they put all the controls on, you don't have all the times the kind of star shot, you know, where they draw something completely. But I think it's all been rather amazing in terms of the statistical measures that they use for analyzing whether there is any kind of anomalous communication. So, but again, I understand where you're coming from. That's not really your thing, I guess.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. It wasn't. But, you know, but I'm fascinated. Yeah, I'm, you know, isn't this like a huge shift if someone like, if somebody from the skeptical community says, actually, there may be some truth in this. Isn't that like a kind of major thing?
Well, you know, that's funny. I mean, that's what I've really focused on in the last few years. And that, to me, seems the more interesting story in the whole issue of parapsychology is that really, it's not that amazing when you dig into the research. I mean, if you look at, for example, I don't know if you've ever heard of Dean Radin and his presentiment effect, but what they do is they hook these people up to a bunch of sensors like an EEG. Anyways, they show them a picture. It's either a very provocative, the sexual picture, a violent picture, or just a kind of pastoral kind of flower, grassy thing. And they find that they actually react to the picture that appears on the computer screen before it's even selected by the computer. So it doesn't make any sense in terms of the way that we normally understand things. It's a precognition kind of effect. But there's an experiment that's been replicated in three different continents, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 universities. Of course, it just never gets much traction because it doesn't fit into the way we normally understand things, and it's just kind of an anomalous little thing that happens that we can't quite explain. But that's really what we've been interested in on this show.
Well, I think that's fascinating. I mean, my you know, I've always been much more interested in people than in science. I've always thought that, you know, if you could work out what makes people tick, then you get to the root of the story. And in fact, I'm continuing to do that in a book I'm writing at the moment. So, but, you know, having spent so much time, you know, looking into the people behind these sorts of experiments, I'm fascinated to hear the, you know, the kind of new scientific thought on them.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the people. I think it's a fascinating comparison myself in terms of talking to a lot of skeptics and not being completely really or very much at all impressed with some of their science, if you will.
Yeah.
But I think the interplay between the hardcore skeptical community, I'm not putting you in that group, but you obviously...
Yeah, well, I'm not. I mean, well, I come and go. I mean, basically, you know, I gave a talk to them about 7 or 8 years ago, Skeptics in the Pub, when my book Them came out. And I was kind of amazed that they even existed, that people would meet once a month and become skeptical. And I remember saying to them, you know, isn't that kind of weird? And they all went, you know, no. But then after 9/11, when, you know, thought became so irrational with the truthers, you know, gaining such popularity and so on. And, you know, the people on both sides of the fence behaving in an incredibly irrational way. You saw the Bush government and the Blair government behaving very irrationally. And you also saw radicals and free thinkers becoming truthers. And, you know, irrationality seemed to sweep the world. And then I really found that there was... There was something important about skepticism, because I thought that a hardcore truth, you know, there is no 9/11 conspiracy, you know, certainly nothing like the way that the truthers see it, was really, really valuable. And I found myself, you know, feeling much warmer towards the skeptics after that.
Let's talk a little bit about religion, Christianity, and what have you found in the Alpha Course work that you've done?
For people who don't know, the Alpha Course is I forget how many weeks. It's usually about 10 weeks with a weekend away in the middle, and it's advertised in quite a vague way. Is this it? Say the posters. You know, if you want to discuss the meaning of life, come on an Alpha Course. So it's advertised almost like a sort of philosophical version of Alcoholics Anonymous, where, you know, people who've got a slight want in their lives will turn up at the local church and they'll just discuss the meaning of life in quite a sort of gentle way. There'll be a talk at the beginning, a talk that's written by the Alpha founder, who's a guy called Nicky Gumbel, who's an evangelical, very nice man, actually. I've met him at lots of times, and as a person, I like him, even though he's got some weird views about homosexuality. So they'll meet once a week, and it's very gentle. What they don't realize, these agnostics or atheists, is that actually behind what looks like a very gentle, rambling thing is a very well thought out structure. And by about week 5 or 6, the agnostics are asked to go away on a weekend away, a Holy Spirit weekend, where they're invited, pretty much apropos of nothing, to speak in tongues, which comes as a huge shock to most of them, because they thought it was all about, you know, nice chocolate biscuits and nice chats, and suddenly they're asked to speak in tongues. But for some of them, it's the moment when they become overwhelmed by the Holy Spirit and they join the church. Now, what happens that weekend is the big negative, I think, which is that suddenly the curtains are opened and, you know, it becomes quite heavy, you know, these people saying, you know, do you want me to pray for you? Will I pray for you? And it becomes very much about a recruitment for Christianity. Then you sort of think, what is it? It's all about that, really. You know, all the nice chats were sort of a lie, you know, in a way.
Well, maybe. Here's what intrigues me about that whole issue. I mean, I think we've dug into a little bit, and we will more in this show, on just the kind of ludicrous notion of biblical inerrancy, and just some of the Christian notions just are kind of way out there, and they're downright cultish if you really kind of deconstruct them in any kind of rational way. But at the same time, what we've also looked into is the legitimacy, in any way we'd normally measure it, of these kind of transformative spiritual experiences. I mean, these things, gosh, they just seem to happen. They happen across culture, they've happened across time, and they do transform people's lives. So did you get any insight into whether there is any there in terms of these spiritual experiences that people are having, or did you come away with the conclusion that it's all just hallucination and fantasy?
I've done Alpha a number of times, two or three times now, and on each occasion I didn't believe the tongues. I just didn't. I you know, if they say that the tongues is actually opening yourself up to the Holy Spirit coming into your life in a way that's completely out of your control, that's certainly not what I saw. You know, I saw people very much in control, you know, using their own language.
I'll just give you a quick example. I mean, we had someone on the show recently, and she's a medical doctor from Canada. She had a near-death experience, actually had a couple, published her book in Canada, and, you know, had a patient starting showing up at her door saying, you know, gee, I was praying and I had this transformative experience. I'm a yogi, I'm a Buddhist, you know, all these people who had these rather troubling physical experiences after going through these kind of amazing different spiritual experiences. I don't think it's something we deal with very much in our current culture, but certainly it's something that has happened throughout time. And I just wondered if you thought there was any legitimacy, but I understand where you're coming from. You say if that's there, you didn't encounter it and you haven't encountered it personally. I don't know if you have any opinions in general, whether you think that anyone out there is really having any kind of, again, I don't know, I want to avoid putting any kind of religious labels on it, so we're just calling it this kind of transformative spiritual experience that seems to transform their life and their life goes in a different direction. And
that definitely happens. I mean, you know, people are you know, have wants and needs, and some of those people, you know, find those needs fulfilled by, you know, spiritualism and Christianity, but there's no doubt about that at all. And I wouldn't bemoan them it one bit. But it certainly didn't work for me. And you know, as an observer, as a kind of, you know, rational observer with no particular axe to grind, I didn't, with one exception, I didn't see anything that made me believe in these miracles. And the one exception was the first time I did the Alpha course. I write about this in a Guardian article that I did on the Alpha course a number of years ago. And I wrote about how I was thinking about my son, Joel, and about the fact that it took us a few years to conceive him. And just as I was thinking about that, I was thinking that, you know, in a sort of theoretical sense or in a sort of metaphoric sense, Joel was like a gift from God. And just as I said that, I was in the back of the church and Nicky Gumbel, the Alpha founder, was on stage and he said, Joel. And I looked up and he was reading from the book of Joel. And the line he read was, "I will repay you for the years the locusts have eaten," which I suppose, you know, could be read as a message from God saying to me, you know, it took you a long time to conceive your son, and I am now repaying you for the years the locusts have eaten. But even with that, obviously they were thrilled, you know, when I told them that. Nicky Gumbel was just incredibly excited that, you know, possibly a journalist in his midst was about to find God, you know, via him. But I'm afraid I stand here as a, you know, many years later as an agnostic. And, you know, I have seen, on the other hand, I have seen alpha clergy people behaving in ways that I don't think are ethical. So for all of that, you know, I've seen the other side of things that I you know, that really turned me off.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really interested in it as a social tool for kind of hurting people or even just the kind of ordinary transformations that people go through in terms of making their life better. I'm more interested in, at least in terms of the way we're talking about it, truly unexplainable transformative experiences that people have that change their life in terms of giving them psychic powers, ability to see things and hear things beyond their thing. Which, you know, one last question, and I'll kind of get off this because I realize it's really not totally into your thing, and it's much more interesting to talk about someone who has a major Hollywood movie coming out with George Clooney than to rattle on about this stuff. But I wonder if you've ever encountered anything with the whole near-death experience.
Well, in fact, you know, and I'm sorry to be such a skeptic here, but, you know, in fact, you know, I did do some research into near-death experiences, and I made a film a few years ago. It's a really, if I can blow my own trumpet, it's a really very good documentary called Reverend Death, and it was about the assisted suicide underground, where basically a bunch of people would roam America helping, you know, non-terminally ill people commit suicide. And one of them was a guy called George Exo, who's a Unitarian minister from Beckley, West Virginia. And George would travel America and, in fact, the world, helping non-terminally ill people kill themselves. And one of the things he would do to counsel them was play them the Raymond Moody video, Life After Life, you know, the famous near-death experience video, which features a guy called Danian Brinkley, who I think is one of the main sort of poster boys for near-death experiences. You know, he had this kind of remarkable story to tell about how he died for, you know, ages and ages. I think he said he died for 28 minutes, and he went up to a crystal city and, you know, spoke to God and all of this kind of business. And I actually spent a bit of time researching Danny and Brinkley's claims, and I'm afraid they did not hold up at all. You know, I found some newspaper articles from the time which said that he was struck by lightning, and basically the newspaper articles at the time said that, you know, he was out for a couple of seconds. I mean, I can't give you the exact facts here because I don't have them to my fingertips, but basically over the years I proved, you know, slightly unfortunately, because I think Danny Pinkley is probably a lovely guy who does a lot of good for people.
Why unfortunately? Well, I don't know. I don't understand that. I mean, here's my thing. Again, I think it's very interesting, and I can't wait to see that. I'll see if I can dig it up, or if someone has torrented it. I hate to admit that I will look for a torrent. But
I'm not necessarily against that, because, you know, if you can't see it in any other way, you know, I'd rather it was seen than not
right.
seen.
Right. How are we supposed to see it? But here's my point, I guess. Again, the people part of it, I understand, and I'm sure you do a great job with that, and that it's somewhat insightful. But in terms of really understanding whether or not there's anything there, why do we really care that much about Danian Brinkley, particularly when in the last 20 years there's been just mountains of solid scientific evidence published in peer-reviewed journals that establish that near-death experience is unexplainable by any kind of current medical knowledge. I mean, there's just hundreds and hundreds of accounts. They do it in hospitals after people have had heart attacks, where we know, you know, that their brain is stopped. So, well, that's kind of curious.
Well, I can only speak, I mean, you know, what I'm doing throughout this entire interview is really only speaking to the things that I've had personal experience with. And,
sure,
you know,
sure.
Danny and Brinkley, I've met, and I kind of confronted him. The reason why I say unfortunately about him is because I think he's a really nice guy, and I felt slightly bad about telling him that I had evidence to prove that he'd massively exaggerated his story. And he is a kind of poster boy for the movement to an extent. And so that's why I say unfortunately. And had I investigated somebody else who'd claimed to have a near-death experience, I might have found a completely different story. But he's the only one I investigated, and his story did not hold up. You know, I'm sorry to say. Listen, I would love more than anyone to be able to verify near-death experiences, because I'd rather like to go to a crystal city myself when I die. And so I really hope it's true. But in the case of Danny and Brinkley, I can only say that, you know, I'm afraid his story doesn't hold up.
Fair enough. And we can direct anyone to kind of follow that up. So,
yeah, if anybody can watch Reverend Death, I'm sorry that I'm not being more specific about the facts of it, but it's all in the documentary Reverend Death.
Great. Well, you know, thanks so much for talking with us today. Tell us a little bit more about what's coming up for you. And you mentioned a new book. What is that all about, and when will we see that?
Well, I'm sort of keeping it a bit secret, but I'm writing it every day. So all I'm doing at the moment is working on it full time. So I'm kind of going crazy like Kasper Hauser in this room. Just, you know, I'm here from dawn to dusk, and then I kind of crawl out of the room and like a wolf child and attack any human who happens to be in my vicinity, which is usually my wife and son. So they've got kind of bite marks all over them. But I don't really want to talk about what it's about, because I sort of think it's good to keep secret about these things, but it's good, you know. What I would say is that, you know, I couldn't really do conspiracy theories anymore ever since I got kind of attacked by the 9/11 truthers, and I lost my sense of humor about conspiracies. And I sort of felt I couldn't really do the paranormal anymore after the Menesteric Goats. I felt like I'd kind of done that journey. But this new book is about, you know, it's in the same sort of world that's of interest, I think, to skeptics and to people who are interested in these subjects. But it's something that I can still kind of believe in, so I can still get excited about it.
Well, that's some tantalizing clues that is going to keep everyone looking for the next release. Well, that's great.
Well, I intend to publish it. I intend to deliver it next summer, and for it to be published in the spring of 2011. That's the plan anyway. And I really hope I can stick to that plan.
Well, great, John. We'll look for that. And again, thanks so much.
Thank you. And in the meantime, and can I just plug in the meantime, the fact that the movie tie-in edition of my book, The Menesteric Goats, is going to be out in the next couple of weeks. And, you know, I think, hope people in, you know, if they want to find it.
I am going to be queued up the first guy in line with my wife there for our date night, looking for The Men Who Stare at Goats. It sounds great. And George Clooney, and who else is in it?
George Clooney, Ewan McGregor, Kevin Spacey, and
wow.
Jeff Bridges.
Did you get to rub shoulders with all these big-time celebs?
I did. I went to the premieres in Venice and Toronto, and spent a couple of days on the set.
Wow, cool.
It was a kind of, you know, I mean, I'm back to being the kind of regular schmuck I was, you know, before all this happened, and so I'm kind of back to normal. But it was nice.
I don't think that's going to last long, do you?
Well, as you know, I sort of think that in the end, you know, you're on your deathbed, and what do you look back on? And I think, you know, what you look back on is the idea that life is should be a series of adventures, you know, and if nothing else, you know, watching a movie get made based on one of your books is an adventure, and I think that's kind of amazing.
Absolutely, especially for someone who's a filmmaker themselves.
Yeah, completely.
Well, best of luck.
Thank you very much, and thanks for wanting to do this.
Yes, very good. Take care, John.
Okay, bye now. Bye.
So that's the conversation we had a couple months ago, and I have to say that afterwards, I was a little bit peeved. I was kind of a lot peeved. And I did some research, and I actually found a copy of the documentary Reverend Death, and I had a look at that. And then I took a step back, and I kind of looked at, why was I so ticked off by this guy? And it really hinged on the one thing that he said, and he kind of repeated it in the email exchange we had. He kept saying, I'm sorry that I didn't find anything here. I'm sorry that psi phenomena aren't real. I'm sorry that near-death experience aren't real. And it was kind of in a cheeky, condescending way that I guess when I really looked at it, I could relate to because I've done it enough times. And when I really thought about it some more, that's what I guess peeved me, was that I felt the same way. I felt, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, John, that you've never really looked at the research. I'm sorry that you've never read any of the research on remote viewing and have never spoken with Hal Puthoff or any of the people who were really involved in the military's use of remote viewing, let alone people like Stephen Schwartz, who've applied remote viewing to archaeology, where it's also been applied to archaeology in a university setting, and there's many, many published papers on it. And I'm sorry that you've never done any really serious research into near-death experience. And in the email exchange we had following this interview, and I have to say he was very forthcoming in responding to my emails, and I had to persist a little bit on a couple of topics, but he always got back to me and followed up. But ultimately, what the result of that exchange was that he hasn't read any of the research on near-death experience, and he isn't familiar with any of the book other than Raymond Moody's book, which is, of course, over 30 years old at this point. So I'm sorry that he hasn't applied the best science to really answering the underlying question of whether there is any reason to believe that near-death experience is real. Because, of course, if he did, he'd find overwhelming evidence that the conventional materialistic explanation that consciousness doesn't survive death, well, that really doesn't hold up anymore. So I'm really glad that John Ronson joined us today on Skeptico, and I appreciate him taking the time and interest in engaging in this dialogue. But at the same time, I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed that, as John's documentary work shows, you can get close to a topic, and you can reveal part of the truth, and at the same time, you can miss the deeper underlying truth. And I guess the same would go for the men who stare at goats. Do I really care as a U.S. citizen whether my armed forces piddled away money looking at bizarre phenomena that could never really have any military application? Well, I guess I am. But as a person, as a human being, I'm much more interested in the underlying phenomena and what that means about my true nature. And that seems to me to be the real scientific question behind all this. So that's going to do it for this episode of Skeptico. If you'd like more information about this show, including a link to the interview I did a while back with someone who I think is really one of the more interesting people in the remote viewing field, Stephen Schwartz, check out our website. It's at skeptico.com. That's S-K-E-P-T-I-K-O. Don't forget the K. And there you'll find links to all our previous shows, our forum, an email link to me, as well as transcripts of our shows. We'll have a number of interesting interviews coming up on Skeptico, including diving back into the near-death experience research and what's going on there. So until next time, bye for now.